Chapter 3 Fallen Angels. Harlots, prostitutes, whores, or whatever we choose to call them, are given a multi-layered definition in the Old Testament, inclusive of everything bad that can be attributed to women. An explanation of what prostitution derives from may, however, be clarified through a close look at its prime narrative about creation and man's original sin. What happened in the Garden of Eden? Did Eve straightforwardly destroy Adam and lead humanity out of paradise into corruption and depravity? Leading Protestant female theologians agree that Eve is not a dominant figure in the Israelite canon. While one of the most problematic figures in the whole of the scriptures, she is mentioned in only three short paragraphs, an odd mixture of creation myth and parable that explain the origin of sin. Then, Eve is never mentioned again. And still, Genesis's narrative about man's fall has raised discussions in Christian and Jewish theology and folk belief for millennia. The Jewish and Protestant traditions assign the greatest blame to the rebel archangel Satan and his party of fallen angels, and they emphasize how the eloquent phallic snake tempted Eve into the disaster of sin. The Roman Catholic Church blamed Eve and supported that view by canonizing a text from the 2nd century BC, sometimes called Ecclesiasticus, sometimes referred to by its author, Ben Zira or Jesu Sirach. A related, somewhat younger text, the Book of Adam and Eve, even allows Eve to speak for herself and leaves no doubt about the source of sin and suffering. Eve says straight out that she is a deeply libidinous vessel, wicked and not to be trusted. This view of women differs from the dominating ideas of the Old Testament. There can be no emphasis on woman's weakness, since her sex seems innately obscene. During the last 2 centuries BC, Greek Orphic mysticism had spread from Asia Minor to the Jews of the Middle East, and the Greek Orphics stressed the weakness of the flesh, particularly in women. Orphic influence is clearly detectable in Ben Zira's text, but totally dominates the Book of Adam and Eve. This text of Eve never became part of any canon. Few read it today. But it was known and read in the ancient Christian church, where the influence of Orphic mysticism continued to be strong, and its impact is easy to detect in the epistles of Paul. The story of Eve and the apple from Genesis may appear to be an innocent tale, but thick-skulled and misogynist Greek influence upgraded it to a vision of horror. Adam lived to the age of 930.
Methuselah was 969 when he died.
Christianity's and Judaism's most mythic texts account for the extraordinary longevity of the patriarchs' lives. Nobody bothered to find out Eve's lifespan. Her daughters are just as problematic. Between Eve and Sarah, Genesis reels off an almost endless list of men, but only two women, Ada and Zillah, probably named only due to the renown of their sons, who changed human civilization. Ada's first son tamed the first cattle, and her second son created music. Zillah's son helped both as he created the first bronze and iron tools. Meanwhile, Adam and his descendants had been driven out of paradise, clad in skins, bereft of apples and manna, and in most ways unprepared for the life that awaited them. Finally, God sent two handsome guardian angels, Grigori, Azazel, and Semyaza, to look after them. As early as in the 7th century BC, Rabbi Elkaiser began a campaign against these two great mothers, presumably due to their assumed wicked sexual behavior. "When the angels fell from heaven, the daughters of Cain examined them and showed them their genitalia. They had painted their eyes as harlots. After the angels had been seduced by the women, they took wives among them." Similar descriptions would be repeated in later and less venerable Jewish writings. Obviously, the daughters of Eve barely needed to throw a glance at Azazel and Semyaza to discover that they were sexually useful. Then they applied paint to their faces and let themselves loose upon the angels. It had taken only a couple of generations on Earth to make women as wild and aggressive as animals. According to theology, God and Satan, angels and demons, exist outside time and history and beyond gender. They are ageless and sexless. But since human life, thought, and perception are sex and gender-based, they all appear to us in human form as male or female. How could civilizations ruled by men come to imagine God and Satan in a form other than their own sex? On the other hand, should images of God be avoided totally? To some extent, this applied to angels too. The higher in the heavenly hierarchy, the more sexless they tend to be in human depictions. The archangels Uriel and Michael appear extremely manly and were indeed strong and powerful, while Gabriel and Raphael look almost like women. But such high-status angels always lack sexual organs when they are depicted. Angels of the lower orders appear more normal, to human eyes at least. Guardian angels and others of lower rank are depicted with sexual organs, but smaller than those of humans. Angels are also said to be sexually passive, in no way seducers. But they may, of course, be seduced, as Ada and Zila easily found out at the start of the time of man. It is quite the opposite in the circles of hell, of course. The formerly fallen angels and their devil descendants appear to the human senses very well endowed, bisexual or pansexual, and seductive. According to both Rabbi Elkeizer and later mythical sources, Ada and Tzila produced a number of descendants, with God's guardian angels as their fathers.
The question of how angels and humans could beget children
has engendered theological conflict. The practical conclusion, by the majority of those who have ventured opinions throughout history, is that mating angels with humans is like mating horses and donkeys. Children may come, but celestial bastards are not capable of populating the world in later generations. This point of view is the most humanistic position, especially when the same discussion arose over a millennium later, this time related to the offspring of humans and devils. Angels are never sexually offensive, though this should not count heavily against anyone, since angels are purely good by nature. But only women can get pregnant and be forced to justify their actions by pointing out how heavenly the father of their child really was. While the Catholic Church gives the female sex the lion's share of the burden of male sin, both Jewish tradition and the later Protestants tend to explain sin with a concept of pure evil, something transcendent of the human realm. When women become harlots and men allow themselves to sin, it is due to demons' influence. And as both Jewish and Christian scholars would argue later, devils are not only purely evil, but always out to seduce humans. For a man, such an experience can be tough enough. Women will suffer twice, both during the seduction and if they have to raise a child who may have inherited most personal qualities from its devil father. In such a mother's defense, she was seduced, if not raped. If the father really was a devil, the offspring would be left alive until it commits real, unforgivable evils as an adult. Tradition's wise compromise position in this complicated demonological dispute would allow many thousands of children to grow up. If the assumed bastard inherited sufficient human qualities, it might get a long life, but humanity would be protected, since it would never produce offspring. If the mother mistook a human seducer for a devil, this doubt also counted in the favor of the child. History's first big debate about this issue broke out among Jewish literati in the 2nd century BC, precisely at the time of Ben Zira. Its main theme was Eve and her descendants on the distaff side, sin and guilt in the Garden of Eden. Many posed Satan and his band of fallen angels against Eve and her descendants. Ben Zira belonged to the minority who placed most of the blame on Eve. But the minority interpretations would prevail just as strongly into the future. In some Jewish renderings, Eve's position as Adam's second wife counts in her defense. It reduces her status, but explains her culpability. According to this competing myth of origin, the first woman in Adam's life was Lilith, a fallen female angel. But early in their relationship, Adam and Lilith encountered problems. Lilith was extraordinarily determined with her demands on poor Adam. She insisted, for instance, on being on top when they made love. Once, when Adam tried to turn her toward the missionary position, she laughed right in his face, got up, and left. Promptly. Good Adam missed the bitch. He pined and regretted, but all in vain. Finally, he was provided with the much sweeter and more obedient Eve, while Lilith had sought out more compatible partners among other fallen angels. We have more information about Lilith than the enigmatic Eve. Lilith was mentioned by the prophet Jesiah, by Matthew, and in Revelations, and she has attracted a good many adherents through history. In the Middle East and along the Black Sea, she was known as the owl goddess, but also the goddess of love. In ancient reliefs, she was portrayed as a combination of snake, bird, and human. Some depictions showed her secretively holding the keys to life. Jewish and Christian folklore would eventually make Lilith the bride of Satan. Sometimes she was even portrayed as Virgin Mary's mirror opposite, in the triple role as Satan's mother, wife, and daughter. Satan and Lilith reveal themselves particularly in Jewish mysticism and folklore. But Lilith has remained a lively challenge to male fantasy in general. Extraordinarily fertile, she was constantly giving birth to daughters, collectively called Liloth, a plural derivative of their mother's name. These she-devils had the frightful habit of seeking out men who slept alone, arriving in the dead of night and jumping on top of any poor soul sleeping the sleep of the just. Extremely virtuous and observant bachelors may wake up in time, scared by their unmistakably smutty laughter. These frightened young men fought their fear through jokes. For centuries, celibate Jewish and Christian men jokingly called themselves daughters of Lilith. The mother of all these devilish seductresses, the queen of hell herself, has for her part experienced a recent revival among esoteric feminists of the West. Women's bookstores, Jewish feminist periodicals, lesbian cafes, even a highly commercial music festival have been proudly named after her. Significantly, it was not the second milder woman in Adam's life, but his first and most difficult wife, the first female rebel of our civilization's most venerable myths, who has become the feminist symbol. Although angels and devils in theory are beyond sex and gender, the individual angel or devil tends to appear with a majority of features of one sex. Some feminine angels have been associated with prostitution and the sale of sex, like Iseth Zenuim and Agrath Bamalat. Unfortunately, they are not guardian angels of prostitutes. They belong to the fallen party. Accordingly, they promote evil and are normally described as Satan's brides and whores. Asmodeus was the best known, most portrayed, and most attractive in this bad crowd. He has wandered from text to text, from the apocryphal Book of Tobit to Jewish folklore and Protestant fiction. Asmodeus was the personified whoremaster, the prince of hell, the greatest, most irresistible seducer. The only protection against him was intense prayer for the archangel Michael. Only he would force Asmodeus to retreat. In all other situations, Asmodeus was victorious and bent both men and women to his sexual will. Although Lilith was the queen of hell, Satan's favorite was Naamah, the pleasant, who was also the mother of Asmodeus. Despite a rebellion against his father's reign, he was the most attractive to Satan and to every whore in his harem. Hell shall thus be seen as populated by an army of seducers, Lilith and her daughters, Satan's whores and the angels of prostitution, with Asmodeus as spearhead. Everything they do is united into one idea. All have the same goal, to tempt and arouse humanity to greater sins. Satan might well be slightly sex-tired now and then, but he regains his power enlightened by his enormous, evil master plan, of which all whoredom and harlotry are parts. He certainly is obsessed by his constant evil plans against his one and only rival.